HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 256, recorded live Wednesday, March 2nd, 2011. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Elijah Manner and Dave Ward about taking your JavaScript knowledge to the next level.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'm here on campus at Microsoft, and this is a very special show. Why do you ask? It's because it's show number 256.
8 bits of Hansel Minutes.
It is 8 bits of Hansel Minutes. It's a very special show. It is our round number show. Show 200 went by without even a thought, but show 256 will not go unrecognized. And here, Dave Ward, with your wonderful radio voice. Thank you, sir, for joining me.
I'm happy to be here.
And we've also got the man who has more Twitter followers than Scott Goo, Elijah Manner. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well.
You have too many Twitter followers. How many do you have now?
It's close to 31,000.
That's a problem. I'm taking you down, my friend. We just actually came out of some sessions at the MVP Summit. We've been talking about JavaScript. There's been a lot of JavaScript discussion. And I want to come at this with the direction of a person who kind of, I know JavaScript, but I don't know JavaScript. Like, I understand alert. I understand on click. I understand JavaScript as a piece of glue that allows me to hook up some actions to my markup, but I don't really think that I, as a professional engineer, have really accepted JavaScript as its own language. I don't give it the respect that it needs. And then I also have a tendency to tweet kind of smart-ass things about JavaScript, like no one really writes JavaScript anymore. They only write jQuery. And I said to myself, here are two guys who respect the language and care about the language, and you would help me develop my sense of smell. So, I mean, do I have my head wrong, or do you think that it's true that there are a whole cast of programmers out there that kind of know JavaScript but haven't really accepted it into their life? They don't know the good news about JavaScript.
Yeah, I think you have it right. I think most of the developers that I come across and you know, looking at blogs on the internet, it seems a lot of people know how to just do all the basic stuff. jQuery has really made the language a lot more popular and accessible, and mainly because it's made working with the DOM easier. You don't have to worry as many of the cross-browser issues, which has become popular. But the more that you write jQuery, you're going to run into problems if you don't really know JavaScript well. And which kind of led me to, I'm actually going to speak at Mix about this topic, because I see, especially, well, C# developers, because that's what the people that I know, seem to make the same common mistakes, because they program JavaScript as if it were C#. And there are actually many differences. JavaScript is probably more akin to F#, and because it's functional nature, and it is dynamic as well, which is slightly different. But if you don't understand those things, you could run into a lot of problems. And just, you know, the scope is different. So if you have an if block, one C#, you know, between the curly braces, you're like, oh, if a variable's in there, it stays in there. But in JavaScript, it's not. And so you could run into a lot of problems. And for loops are a little bit different. And anyway, so I came up with this talk because I was doing a front-end architecture review for a client, and they were making all the same mistakes that I made initially, and then I've slowly learned over time, just studying, you know, Douglas Crockford and reading his book. And so I really think, unless you're doing something very trivial, which is usually the demos that you see, people usually pick that up and just, they'll write a really complicated app, but use those simple techniques, and your code becomes kind of unmaintainable and tightly coupled. And there's actually a lot of nice JavaScript patterns you could pick up to really split that out.
Do you agree with that, Dave? The idea that I see curly braces and I go, oh, I know a curly brace language. I'll write this other curly brace language in the same way.
Yeah, I think Elijah had 2 points exactly that were just right. It's so easy to try to write C# in JavaScript, you know, going too far toward the object-oriented paradigm instead of, you know, embracing either, you know, none of it. You don't have to necessarily have objects. You can just use namespaced objects to hold your code. Or, you know, doing the really complex objects where you end up having more plumbing code than actual code that is running your site. I think that's a big problem. And also not embracing the fact that it's a dynamic language. Because that really is a beautiful thing when you're working with the UI.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's where a static language like, you know, C# is actually sort of messy.
That's interesting. That first aspect, let's talk about that. The idea that JavaScript is really a truly dynamic language. We hear people complaining about lack of IntelliSense in JavaScript, and C# programmers and BB programmers say, well, I don't really like JavaScript because I feel like I'm out there without a net, and you really are. But it's not necessarily a deficiency of the tools sometimes. It's honestly, the JavaScript stuff that's going on inside of Visual Studio is pretty amazing. It's actually not a deficiency, but a strength of the language that you just don't know until you run it what's going to happen.
Yeah, that's true. I liken it to regular expressions. You know, every time that you need a regex for something, you have to go back out and learn the syntax. It's one of those things that you use just infrequently enough that you know it can do what you want. You just don't know how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that JavaScript is the same way for a lot of people who have been, maybe copy-pasting some snippets from Dynamic Drive or something like that, or using the things that frameworks will generate, like ASP.NET, and just enough to, you know, be dangerous, but not necessarily be able to sit down and write some JavaScript from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that sort of tipping point where you really have to, you know, embrace the language, embrace the strengths of it. And I think that that's probably because people use it just infrequently enough to remember the pain points.
Mm-hmm.
They never get past the tipping point where they start to see the true benefits of using it.
Yeah. I want to understand how I can go from a beginner to kind of an apprentice and work my way up to kind of a journeyman, because I was looking at some code that Steve Sanderson wrote that we demonstrated during the summit here on Knockout.js, and I had Steve on the show a couple of weeks ago, and he had built an entire view model. And again, this will just belie my own ignorance, but it had methods and properties, and they were interacting between each other. It was really quite a beautiful thing, and I looked at it and could read it, but couldn't visualize a world where I could write that myself. Do you know what I'm saying? So I think you're right that I'm still at that basic level where I say, oh, they've got for loops, I've got for loops. They've got switch statements, I've got switch statements. But how to make that transition? I mean, the basic structure about, like, what does a good JavaScript object look like? What kind of behavior should it have? And then you brought up the issue of namespace scoping. It's a little bit overwhelming.
Yeah, I think a lot of C# developers don't realize that, you know, the fact that they can namespace in C# is a good thing. But when they go to write JavaScript, everything's on the global object. Like, they just use function and a name, and they go on. And they don't realize, actually, that's a bad thing, because especially in browsers like Chrome and stuff, all the extensions that you install, your functions could conceivably conflict with their code as well.
Really? So those are all living in the same place?
Yeah, if you actually open up the, you know, debugger, or the, you know, to look at your code and select all the scripts, because mm-hmm. you want to debug your script, well, among that script is like all the extension scripts as well. So
how does it work at all? I mean, it makes me wonder how that's possible.
Yeah, I mean, I've run into some extensions that it broke a page because they were conflicting in what they were using. And so that's really one of the importance of using namespacing your stuff. And there's some simple patterns. Actually, there's several ways to do it, but Douglas Crockford, in his book, JavaScript, The Good Parts, really outlines several techniques that you could have an object with public and private properties, public and private methods, mm-hmm. just kind of like you're used to in C#. But most people don't realize that. And by doing so, you're protecting the global namespace, so you're not going to conflict with all these other libraries. So yeah, if you don't like to read, which sometimes it's hard to read, there's a great, he did the same content basically in a video series on Yahoo. You can actually go there and watch it. But he outlines a lot of these techniques, that most developers don't know.
Elijah also brought up a good point there in terms of, you know, there are a lot of different ways to create objects and set up, you know, your inheritance, prototype and things like that in JavaScript. But something that I think probably because most of the sample code you're going to see, if you look at something that's that we get in ASP.NET often, is a framework. It's something that is meant to be very, very generic, that works in every case.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to see a little bit more architecture than you probably need for your website. You know, I think that's something that I see an awful lot. And it adds to the complexity, going back to what you said about, you know, if I'm just starting, you know, how much do I really have to learn? And if you add all this plumbing on top of the core concepts, it really makes it harder to approach.
And then you bring up a really interesting point that kind of resonates with me, that as a purported educator, I'm going to try to put out samples there and encourage people to put out samples. But if that sample says, include these 9 files, and by the way, beyond JavaScript itself as a language, you need to understand these 2 other frameworks, then that can be really overwhelming. But then at the same time, if I put out a sample, inevitably something is going to be copy-pasted directly from that sample, and it was a naive sample. And no matter how many times you put things in bold and red on the sample, that this is a naive sample, do not copy-paste it. It will end up in production somewhere.
Absolutely.
So it feels like there's a gap, and that gap is basic working knowledge of JavaScript and then creating object models and hierarchies and namespaces. What should I be doing? Should I be reading books or should I be reading source code?
I think reading source code is a really good idea. I absolutely agree with Crockford's JavaScript, The Good Parts.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really concise book. You can read it very quickly. I think it's just 100 pages or so. And that is a good primer. I don't know if I would recommend starting with that first because it assumes a little bit of knowledge. But absolutely, reading code. I know that you're a proponent of that. And that's definitely one of the best ways. And especially JavaScript is always out there. You can view source on so many websites. How did they do this? View source, and now you know. Or look at it in something like Firebug.
Mm-hmm.
Just to piggyback on that, Paul Irish, he's one of the jQuery team members. Mm-hmm. He has 2 videos. The first one is called 10 Things I Learned from Reading the jQuery Source. And he actually dives into some really complicated but approachable things. It's a really great video. And then it was so popular. I mean, tons of people watched it that he did another one, like 11 more things he learned from the jQuery source.
Well, that's a lot of things.
So, but I highly recommend those because, some of those patterns, I learned from watching him. And then it encouraged myself to look at jQuery source more closely.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just picking up a lot of the techniques that modern JavaScript uses, because you'll see lots of code snippets on the web of like old ways to do things.
See, that's interesting right there. Modern JavaScript, because it's clear that JavaScript as a language can no longer be avoided. With old style web forms, 2002, 2003, and then the original Ajax toolkit stuff, the idea was abstract away HTML, abstract away JavaScript. And jQuery embraces JavaScript, but abstracts away browser inconsistencies. But then you just said kind of a hot button issue for me, which is modern JavaScript. How do I know when I'm reading some code if it's modern or not modern? And does that mean modern in form, or does that mean that only certain browsers understand it, or only certain JavaScript, interpreters or JavaScript compilers can understand that? Did the language change or did the techniques change?
It's more the techniques. From my perspective, when I say modern JavaScript, I'm more talking about not embedding, code in your HTML elements, like, having that separation of concern where your markup is your markup, and then you add to that in your JavaScript. And so you attach to things. And that way, if just having a clean separation just helps things out. And another obvious thing to see if it's old is it namespaced or not, Just like we talked about before.
What does that mean? Like, give me an example, a concrete example of namespaced or not.
Like, are all your functions, just at the root in your file?
Is that like, I would say function Hanselman.cool, and that's namespaced versus just a cool function?
So instead of saying like function space, Hanselman's function, open print, close print, instead of doing something like that, you would first create an object, and then you would define the method off of the object.
I see.
And so that way you could define multiple methods, but you attach them to your object.
So when you say the root, that scope, that's an object
like the
itself.
Window scoped. Like if you just open up a text editor and just start typing immediately, that will be attached to the window.
I see.
So if you don't actually attach it to something, it's going to be attached to the window. And that's where the collisions can happen. So, those are just some techniques that it's just like, I probably shouldn't do it that way.
Mm-hmm.
There's a better way.
So there's nothing in the language to prevent me from doing that, but that is an expected convention. It's bad to not do it that way.
Yeah, I think it's probably tough to quantify exactly what is modern and what isn't. It's pretty subjective. That is absolutely one thing, the namespacing, because I think a lot of people don't realize if you just type a variable name or type a function name, that is window dot that variable and window dot that function. And what you were talking about in terms of the separation of concerns.
That's something you bug me about on a regular basis, Dave, because I'm always, I'll make a JavaScript file, but then I'll put 2 or 3 functions in my markup. And you're like, stop doing that.
Yeah. That's called unobtrusive JavaScript. The idea that you, We can use event handlers that we wire up, you know, completely separate from the HTML, all that markup. Mm-hmm. The concept behind unobtrusive JavaScript is that you completely separate the markup and functionality that you attach to it. Mm-hmm. So instead of, you know, in the past, you've seen window on load and they'll put it right there in the body.
That's how I would do it. And yeah. I did it for years. Window on load, button on click, and all that stuff.
Sure. And we all have. But, and the reason that we did that is because the mechanism for attaching those event handlers, that is part of the DOM. That's not part of the language itself.
The DOM, the document object model.
Yes. And until recently, we didn't have a good abstraction to do that cleanly. Mm-hmm. You know how to do it in jQuery. It's very, very simple to add those handlers. Mm-hmm. But before, it took quite a bit of code to do it completely unobtrusively. So it made sense to do it in line. That's why ASP.NET did it in line, mm-hmm. Originally. And that was fine back then.
Hi, this is Scott coming to you from another place in time. Are you using agile practices to manage your software development? There's lots of tools in the market that manage the steps of a project, but most of them focus on individual roles. Get ready for a solution that caters for the success of the whole team. The guys at Telerik introduced TeamPulse. It's an agile project management tool that'll help you gather ideas, estimate, plan, track progress in a common workspace. Finally, companies, regardless of their size, can use a lightweight and convenient tool that makes all the stakeholders work as a united team, even if they're in different countries. By combining intuitive user interface and the power of Silverlight, TeamPulse removes the roadblocks that you typically face in applying Agile in an effective manner. No more lost data, no disparate systems, no lack of critical analytics regarding the health and velocity of your project. See for yourself. Get a free copy for 5 users and 1 project at Telerik.com/TeamPulse. And please do thank Telerik for supporting Hansel Minutes on their Facebook fan page, facebook.com/TELERIK, Telerik. We do appreciate it. There wouldn't be a Hansel Minutes if there wasn't Telerik helping us.
So if I'm building an application and I've got a lot of JavaScript in my markup now, and I think probably a lot of the listeners do, and if I move that out, I'm going to end up with hundreds of JavaScript files, and am I hooking up my events based on the ID of buttons, or am I trying to make things much more generic and say, well, this is a button of this class? I mean, how do I have that separation of concerns without making a custom JavaScript file for every page?
Well, I think that you'll find a lot of times the stuff is generic enough that you can either find plugins that are already made or abstract your stuff out into plugins. Because often, how many times have you written an on-click for every row of a table cell or mm-hmm. a table, and you'll have, 100 on-clicks on a page or something like that. And with the newer techniques that you can use with JavaScript or the other libraries, you can attach one handler to the table. And as the event comes up to that handler, you can say, well, which row is clicked? And grab its ID or some bit of text out of the table or something like that, and then work based on that. So you turned 100 of those handlers into one. So you actually had a lot of gain and efficiency there, not a loss.
Mm-hmm. And if I've got an application like it has order details, but it only has one order details page, I might have some framework JavaScript that everyone includes, maybe at the master page level, and then I might have page specific JavaScript just for that order details page.
Sure. And especially now with how many script loaders we have that are becoming more mature. And I know Boris is working on Defer.js.
Okay, so there's a lot of information there compressed in a small area. You said script loaders. And you tell us what that is and who's Boris?
Right. Okay. Boris is on the ASP.NET team and he's the developer that actually did most of the work on the templates and the data linking and the globalization plugins. Mm-hmm.
There's been Microsoft's JavaScript. There was Dave Reed, and then Boris Rivers Moore got involved, and now Damien's helping out. There's a lot of people here, and Dave and Elijah are here. Are JavaScript your MVPs? But you could probably can be JavaScript MVPs as well as ASP.NET MVPs. So you know these guys on a first name basis, and you work with them. And then because a lot of this new work in JavaScript is being done out in the open, you can interact with Boris as well just by going and looking at his GitHub page, which is where he does most of his work.
Yeah, and he wants that. He wants that interaction with everyone. Right.
So it's not quite done the way it used to be, where we just, check things into TFS, and then 18 months from now, you find out what Boris is working on. You can actually follow Boris on GitHub. So that was one thing. And then the script loader. You were saying that these script loaders make life easier when we have lots of different scripts. What is a script loader, and why do I care?
Well, I think maybe the lifespan over the past 10 years of how we include these scripts, it's sort of gone from, we started out with just just so little script that it was embedded in the page. Mm-hmm. And then we realized, hey, you know, we're sort of duplicating ourselves and this is messy. So we move it out into a single script file. Mm-hmm. And then we start finding, you know, dozens of scripts that we want on the page. And things like the ASP.NET AJAX library fell sort of to that problem too, you know, where each control would include a separate JavaScript file. Mm-hmm. And then we realized, well, the HTTP connections for each one, often the overhead to make that connection takes more time and resources than downloading the entire file itself. So we realized we have to do something about that. Mm-hmm. And now probably most anyone that's working, you know, with client side stuff now knows you should combine and compress your JavaScript down into as few files as possible, mm-hmm. which is pretty easy these days. There's a lot of tools for it. Well, these days you can actually take advantage of the way that newer browsers work. And by newer, I mean like IE8, even IE7. You know, this isn't a really cutting edge thing, mm-hmm. to actually asynchronously load the scripts in the background. So at the very top of the page, you say, hey, would you pull these scripts in, but don't block the rest of the page. Don't impact my performance very much. Mm-hmm. So that then you can move back toward a more modular approach. So you don't have to have that duplicated JavaScript code included on every page in order to get a single combined file. And so now probably going forward, what you'll see is, like you said earlier, you know, there'll be a single base file that's probably necessary on every single page for common mm-hmm. functionality. But then it's not very costly to have pages just use a script loader to quickly pull in a little file that has page specific functionality. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can really make it more modular, and it makes it easier to work on and maintain too.
I like that.
Yeah. And just to follow up with that, another good thing about most of these libraries, like Defer.js and Lab.js and Require.js, there's lots of them, but not only can you tell it to do it asynchronously, but sometimes there's a specific order that it has to be in. Mm-hmm. And most of them, you could actually say, okay, you know, for these two, download them asynchronously, but execute them in order. But you could choose which ones you want, which is great, because more and more apps are becoming single page apps, mm-hmm. like, you know, just because AJAX, and it's more responsive. And so instead of refreshing and going somewhere else, you need all these tools eventually, but some of them you might need immediately, like Dave was saying. So having the combination of specifying the order is also good. And some of them you might, I don't care, you know, just it could be the last one, then that's fine, because I won't need it maybe till I'm using jQuery templates later on in the app.
Now, you know, within JavaScript, there's all these different plugins, and then within jQuery, there's just a whole community of plugins. And I think it's funny, I mean, people complain about Microsoft and our fragmentation and our lack of documentation, but when you start getting into the JavaScript world, it's just everyone's got an opinion and everyone's got a plugin. Where do I start? I mean, you're rattling off, like you said, Defer.js, and we heard about the Modernizer library before. But by the time a book comes out and the tree's been chopped down and the dead tree has been printed and shipped to my house, something new has come out, where do you go to know that I should use the Modernizer and I should use Defer.js or I should use the AJAX script loader, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, that's actually a big problem. And I get that question a lot. And you know, there is a repository on jQuery, you know, they could go to plugins, but it's really old and the team's looking to revamp it a lot. And to have a section like these are recommended by the team.
Right.
Here's ones that support the jQuery theme roller, which allows you to switch out the colors really easily and make it look nice. And then, you know, possibly maybe have a rating that's from the community. But as of now, it's, you know, what I do is I first go to the jQuery UI because they have a lot of quality widgets that are highly tested unit tests. And that's the thing I look for if I look for a plugin. Are there unit tests behind it? Mm. Another thing is, does it support the theme roller? Because I usually like all my stuff to have a similar look and feel. And when I switch it out.
Theme roller.
Theme roller.
R-O-L-L-E-R. That's something that is a standard way to skin your visual widget.
It's a set of CSS classes that jQuery UI uses behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. And if you conform to those, you could style your own widgets. And then another thing, I just take a look at some of the key figures in the jQuery community and, you know, what are they developing? What are they using in their apps? And, but the story is kind of difficult right now, but, that's kind of the flow I do. And if I don't find what I want, I'll just write my own. But I try to follow those standards, make it themeable, use the jQuery UI widget factory, mm-hmm. which is what the jQuery UI uses behind the scenes. It's an easy framework to create widgets in a good, using best practices.
Okay.
So that's kind of the flow. What do you think, Dave?
Well, Well, I want to say, though, that that works for jQuery and UI widgets and stuff. But what about the general stuff outside of the jQuery community? How do I know? I mean, the modernizer that I keep hearing about is not part of jQuery. And these script loaders are not necessarily part of jQuery.
Well, one thing I was going to say, going back to earlier, you were talking about how you can learn JavaScript by view source, basically. Even though a lot of sites are, you know, minifying their JavaScript and it's hard to understand what it is, if you see something on a site that you like, you right-click and inspect element, and there's a good chance that you're going to see the name of whatever plugin they're using. I found some really great stuff that, like, you know, Elijah said, it was hard to find in other repositories and places like that. In terms of finding just general JavaScript, I think I have to agree with Elijah that, you know, you follow the people in the community. You look at the people on GitHub that are doing interesting JavaScript things and follow them, see what kind of projects they're working on. In terms of just raw JavaScript, it really is, it's explosive right now how much, you know, work is going on. Just
is that,
new stuff
is that
all the time.
The fact that there's an explosion of JavaScript and innovation in that space, is that kind of why it's so hard to follow? I mean, there's no Bible that's come out that says this is what you need to know because it'll be different next year. But you really, to be an effective JavaScript programmer, you really need to be an effective community member. Wouldn't you agree?
Or just, you know, follow a few of...
Not necessarily a community member. I mean, the Forrester Research did this thing a while back about the different kinds of people in the community. You've got critics, contributors, consumers. Just because you're not sitting in a room with a bunch of fools doing a podcast like we are, doesn't mean that you're not a member of the community, right? I mean, a consumer is a proper member of the community, but you can't just be insulated in your basement trying to learn JavaScript on your own because there's just so much innovation going on in the space.
Yeah, a lot of the innovation has seemed to be to come from the HTML5 and CSS3 things that are coming out. And like, what's a good way? Because a lot of developers want to do the new stuff. And so what's a good way that you could use the new stuff but still have a way to support old browsers? Because, you know, your depending on your client, they may or may not be able to only say Chrome 11, you know, or whatever, or IE9. And and so the modernizer, it was made to address that, because a technique a lot of JavaScript libraries used to use is to look at the user agent, you know, what browser am I on, what version, what features is it known to support, and that's very problematic because another one will come out and you have all these conflicts. And so jQuery, several releases ago, basically doesn't do most of those checks. They actually do feature detection. You know, does this browser let me do X, Y, Z? And they test for that. And if it does, it'll go through one branch of code that's more optimal. If it doesn't, it'll have, if it doesn't support this nice feature, then there's some other code that's less optimal, but still gets the job done. And that's how it does a lot of its, that's why it does so well. And so the modernizer was filling a similar gap, but looking at the HTML5 features, like, okay, does this browser support the placeholder attribute, which is, you know, it's kind of like a watermark on a text box.
Oh, okay.
And if it doesn't, then it basically tells you if it does or doesn't. And if it doesn't, then you could provide some polyfill or some mechanism to simulate that, like maybe get a jQuery plugin that does that.
Mm.
And so Modernizer allows, it was written to fill that need of, I want to code really nice looking stuff first. And if not, do something else.
That's interesting. Why does the modernizer sounds like, in the US we call putty or spackle. It's like you've got a wall with a bunch of cracks and you want to smooth it out. You just putty over it.
Yeah.
Kind of like, you know, re-spackle this wall. I thought that jQuery was some of that as well. jQuery kind of spackles over a lot of browser incompatibilities. How are those two libraries related?
Well, it's funny you say that because you heard Elijah just call some of the workarounds polyfills. I guess in the UK, that is some sort of putty
for spackling. Polyfill is a technical term and also a kind of spackle that you can clean up cracks in your wall.
But in terms of the differences, I think that it's just simply that jQuery only really abstracts away things like DOM manipulation and AJAX, and it has a few utility methods, but it really doesn't try to get into the internals of, you know, fixing JavaScript too much. Whereas things like Modernizer, they're more focused on browser features. Things that are just absolutely missing, not things that you can smooth over at all, but that you have to realize, you know, can this thing do it at all or not?
Mm-hmm. Not cracks in the wall, but literal holes. Yeah. I don't support geolocation. How are you going to make IE6 make that happen for
sure.
me? So an example might be if your browser doesn't have geolocation, I still call the same APIs, except you're going to go and look me up by my IP address. So close enough, right?
Yeah. And there, the great thing is once you pair Modernizer with some of these polyfills that are out there, a lot of these new features, like local storage and, geolocation, like you mentioned, mm-hmm. there are libraries that allow the polyfill, technically a polyfill is a library that it lets you program against the same API that is coming. JSON2.js is another one that probably a lot of people know of.
Nice.
So that when you use the code, your code is actually standards code. And if the compatibility layer is necessary, then it's used and you use the less efficient, maybe API call like you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And then automatically, if that code is running in a newer browser, then it's just going to go ahead and use the standards. And so, you know, that's where Modernizer differs, because jQuery is going to give you standard functionality no matter what. You know, you can count on everything that jQuery does, it will do in every browser. Whereas this is just giving you something like Modernizer is just giving you the ability to sort of make some decisions on how to implement newer stuff.
Cool. All right. So I need to go check out Douglas Crockford's JavaScript, The Good Parts, Paul Iris's blog post about things that he learned, two blog posts. Was it 9 things and 11 things that he learned about looking at the jQuery source?
I'd recommend going to GitHub, to the Modernizer project. He has a wiki page there.
Okay.
That has a long list of these polyfills. Really, really interesting stuff.
Fantastic.
And of course, follow Elijah. He tweets
right.
tons and
actually,
tons of great information about this.
If you go and you search Twitter for jQuery and or JavaScript, you will very likely find both of you guys several thousand times a day.
At least.
All right. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with me today.
It was fun.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'll see you again next week. We'll